They crashed through stalls, upturned wine vats, sent dogs howling into the dark. People were tossed aside like ninepins. Piles of real war stories went flying, some landing in the wine, others in the roasting pits. Up onto the outdoor stage hopped the fugitive amphibian. Under the bright imp lights, sending one actor leaping into the arms of a second, causing a third to swan dive into the crowd. It sprang down a trapdoor, closely followed by a heron, reappeared an instant later for another, riding the head of a cardboard goblin. It leapt onto the banner above, clung there with two webbed feet. A heron reared up from below, snapped its beak, and tore the banner asunder. The strip of fabric fell, swung like a jungle vine, and catapulted the frog over the path to land beside the crystal prism where the captive demon sat. By this point I was losing track of where I was and what I was doing. In fact, my essence was fast disintegrating. I could scarcely see. The world was awash with discordant sound. I hopped unthinkingly, changing direction with every hop, seeking to avoid the attack I knew would come. Sure enough, one of my pursuers lost patience with the chase. It must have tried a convulsion, I think. I'd leapt aside, anyway. I didn't see it hit the prism, didn't hear the crystal crack. Not my fault. Nothing to do with me. I didn't see the big black demon give a grimace of surprise and set its long, curved fingernails to the break. I didn't hear the ominous shattering when the entire globe gave way, nor the screams and wailing of the people as the demon leapt into their midst. I knew nothing of it. I knew only the endless pounding rhythms of the chase, felt only my essence softening and seeping into liquid with every desperate hop and spring. I was dying now, but I could not rest. A swifter death flew close behind. Chapter 11 Kitty. Kitty's master looked up from his sofa, a lonely island amid a sea of scattered paper, all scrawled upon with his tight, close script. He was chewing the end of a ballpoint pen, which had left little blue ink stains on his lips. He blinked in mild surprise.
"Didn't think to see you back this evening, Lizzie. Thought you had to get off to your work."
"I do, sir. Very shortly. Now, sir."
"Tell me, did you get hold of that original copy of Peck's Desiderata Curiosa? And what about The Anatomy of Melancholy? I wanted Volume 4, mind."
Kitty's lie was smoothly practiced.
"Sir, I'm sorry I didn't, either of them. The library closed early today. There was a disturbance outside, a commoner's protest, and they shut the gates for safety. I was asked to leave before I found your books."
Mr. Button gave a petulant exclamation and bit harder at his pen.
"Such inconvenience! Commoners protesting, you say? What next? Horses throwing off the bridle? Cows refusing to be milked? Those wretched people need to know their place."
He emphasized this statement with neat little stabbing motions of his pen, then looked up guiltily.
"No offence meant, Lizzie."
"None taken, sir. Sir, who was Ptolemaeus?"
The old man stretched his arms wearily behind his head.
"Ptolemaeus is Ptolemy. A most remarkable magician."
He flashed her a plaintive look.
"Do you have time to put the kettle on, Lizzie, before you go?"
Kitty persisted.
"Was he Egyptian?"
"Indeed he was, though the name is Greek, of course. He came of Macedonian stock originally. Well done, Lizzie. Not many protesting commoners would know that."
"I was hoping to read something by him, sir."
"You'd find that tricky, since he wrote in Greek. I have his main work in my collection, The Eye of Ptolemy. It is required reading for all magicians, since it is very perceptive on the mechanics of drawing demons from the other place. Mind you, the style is tepid. His other writings are known as the Apocrypha. I seem to remember you brought me them from Hernex on your first visit here. They are an odd collection, full of whimsical notions. About that tea?"
"I'll put the kettle on," Kitty said. "Is there something I could read about Ptolemy, sir, while I do that?"
"Goodness, you do have your little fancies. Yes, the Book of Names will have an entry. Doubtless you know which stack it's in."
Kitty read the passage swiftly, with the kettle popping and bubbling behind her. Ptolemaeus of Alexandria. flourished circa 120 BC. Child magician, born into the ruling Ptolemaic dynasty, nephew of Ptolemy the Eighth and cousin of the crown prince, later Ptolemy the Ninth. He spent most of his short life in Alexandria, working at the library, but details remain obscure. A notable prodigy, he acquired a considerable reputation for magic while very young. His cousin is said to have felt threatened by his popularity among the common people, and attempted his assassination. The circumstances of his death are unknown, but it is certain he did not live to a great age. He may have died by violence, or succumbed to bodily frailty. Mention is made, in an Alexandrine manuscript, of a sudden deterioration in his health following a difficult journey, though this is at odds with other records that state he never left the precincts of the city. He is definitely recorded as dead by the time of his uncle's funeral and his cousin's accession to the throne, 116 BC, so is unlikely to have reached his twenties. His papers remained at the library for over 300 years, during which time they were studied by Tertullian and other Roman magicians. Part of his writing was published in Rome as the famous Eye of Ptolemy. The original archive was destroyed in the great earthquake and fire of the 3rd century. Surviving fragments have been collected as his apocrypha. Ptolemy is a figure of historical interest, since he is credited with the invention of several techniques, including the Stoic incision and the Muller shield, both used during summonings until the days of Lo, as well as unusual speculative fantasies, such as the Gate of Ptolemy. All this despite his extreme youth. If he had survived to maturity, he would surely have ranked among the great. His demons, with whom he is said to have had an unusual bond, included Afa, demise recorded, Reket or Necho, fate unknown, Methys, demise recorded, Penrenutet, demise recorded. Mr. Button smiled absently when Kitty brought in the tea.
"Did you find what you wanted?"
"I don't really know, sir, but I do have a question. Is it common for demons to take on the appearance of their masters?"
The magician put down his pen.
"You mean to taunt or befuddle them?" "Certainly. It is an ancient trick, one of the oldest in the book, and one guaranteed to unman the inexperienced. Nothing is more unsettling than facing a phantom of oneself, particularly when the creature uses it to perform provocative contortions. Rosenbauer of Munich was so distressed, I believe, by an accurate depiction of his many affectations, that he threw down his pomade and rushed sobbing from his circle, with melancholy results. I myself have been forced to witness my own body decaying slowly to a rotting corpse, complete with hideous sound effects, while I tried to question it on the principles of Cretan architecture. It is to my credit that my notes made any sense at all. Is that what you mean?"
"Well, actually, no, sir." Kitty took a deep breath. "I wanted to know whether a jinni ever took on its master's appearance out of respect, or even affection, because they were comfortable with it."
She made a face. On hearing it, the idea sounded quite ridiculous. The old man wrinkled his nose.
"I hardly think so."
"I mean, after the magician was dead."
"My dear Lizzie, perhaps, if the magician in question was unusually hideous or deformed, the demon might employ his shape to startle others. I believe Zarbustabal of Yemen did reappear for a time following his demise, but out of respect, goodness, the notion presupposes a relationship between master and slave that would be quite unprecedented. Only a only someone as inexperienced as you would come up with such a quaint conceit. Dear me, dear me."
He tittered to himself as he stretched a hand toward the tea tray. Kitty had set off for the door.
"Thank you, sir. You've been very helpful. By the way," she added, "what was the Gate of Ptolemy?"
From the middle of his sofa, among his mess of papers, the old magician groaned.
"What is it? A ridiculous notion. A myth, a figment, a barrel of moonshine. Save your questions for subjects of value. Now I must work. I have no need for the witterings of foolish assistants. Be off with you. The gate of Ptolemy, indeed.
He winced, waved her pettishly away.
But don't you have a job to go to, Lizzie?
40 minutes later, Kitty alighted from a bus upon the Embankment Road. She wore a thick black duffel coat and chewed intently at a sandwich. In her pocket were the documents confirming her second false identity, Clara Bell. The sky was blackening, though a few low clouds still glimmered a dirty yellow with the city's reflected glow. Below the tide wall the Thames lay distant, shrunk and withered. Kitty passed above a great grey mud bank, where herons stalked amid the stones and flotsam. The air was cold. A strong breeze blew toward the sea. At a bend in the river, the pavement took a sudden 90-degree turn away from the Thames, its route blocked by an extensive building with steep roofs and sharply pointed dormers. Heavy black beams laced its walls. Lit windows gleamed at random heights, casting a rich light upon the street and the dark waters of the river. The upper story projected out above the lower on all sides, here vigorously, here sagging as if about to fall. A faded green sign swung from a pole above the path, so weather-beaten that its words could not be read. This was of small account, since the Frog was a notable local landmark. It was famous for its beer, its beef, and for its weekly domino tournaments. It was also Kitty's workplace in the evenings. She ducked under a low arch and walked down the pitch-black side alley into the pub's yard. As she entered it, she glanced up. A faint red light hovered by the gables. If you looked directly at it, its shape was blurred and indistinct. If you looked away, you saw its outline clearly, a small, neat vigilance sphere, watching. Kitty ignored the spy. She crossed the yard to the main door, which was sheltered from the weather by an ancient blackened porch, and entered the Frog Inn. The bright lights of the taproom made her blink. The curtains had been drawn against the night, and a fire lit in the grate. Its colours flickered in rows of glasses assembled on the bar. George Fox, the manager, was industriously polishing them one by one. He nodded at Kitty as she passed to hang her satchel on the coat rail.
"In your own time, Clara, in your own time."
She glanced at her watch.
"Still 20 minutes before they get here, George."
"Not long enough for what I've got planned for you."
Kitty flipped her hat onto a peg.
"No problem."
She motioned with her head back toward the door.
"How long's it been there?"
"Couple of hours. Usual sort. Just trying to spook us. Can't hear. Won't interfere."
"Okay. Chuck me a cloth."
In 15 brisk and efficient minutes, the taproom was clean and ready. The glasses polished, the table-tops spick and span. Kitty had placed 10 pitchers on the counter above the tap, and Sam, the Frog's barman, began filling them with light brown frothing draughts of beer. Kitty distributed the last of the domino boxes, wiped her hands on her trousers, plucked an apron from a hook, and took up position behind the bar. George Fox opened the main door and allowed the customers in. As usual, the Frog's reputation ensured an ever-changing clientele, and tonight Kitty noticed several people she hadn't seen before. A tall military gentleman, an old lady smiling and shuffling to a seat, a young blonde man with beard and moustache. The familiar click of the dominoes began. Conviviality filled the air. Smoothing down her apron, Kitty hastened between tables and took orders for the evening meal. An hour passed. The remains of thick-slabbed hot beef sandwiches lay on plates at the players' elbows. With the food finished, interest in dominoes quickly paled. The pieces were kept in position on every table, in case the police should raid. But the players now sat up in their seats, suddenly alert and sober. Kitty filled the last few empty glasses, then returned to stand behind the counter, as a man sitting near the fireplace slowly got to his feet. He was old and frail, bent with years. The whole room quietened to a hush.
"Friends,"
he began,
"little of note has happened since last week, so I shall shortly open our meeting to the floor. As always, I would like to thank our patron, Mr. Fox, for his hospitality. Perhaps we could hear from Mary first for news of the American situation.
He sat. At an adjacent table a woman stood, thin-faced and weary. Kitty judged her to be not yet 40, though her hair was flecked with grey.
"A merchant ship came in late last night,"
she began.
"Its last berth was Boston, in the war zone. The crew breakfasted at our café this morning. They told us that the most recent British offensive has failed. Boston is still in American hands. Our army withdrew to the fields, searching for supplies, and has since been attacked. Losses are high."
A low muttering filled the room. The old gentleman half stood.
"Thank you, Mary. Who cares to speak next?"
"If I may." The young bearded man spoke up. He was stocky, self-confident. He carried an assertive air.
"I represent a new organization, the Commoners' Alliance. Perhaps you've heard of it."
There was a general shuffling, a sense of unease. From behind the bar, Kitty frowned. Something about the speaker's voice. It bothered her.
"We're trying to gather support," the man went on, "for a new round of strikes and public demonstrations. We've got to show the magicians what's what. The only way to make them sit up is concerted action by us all. I'm talking mass protests here."
"May I speak?"
The elderly lady, immaculately presented in a dark blue dress and crimson shawl, sought to rise. A chorus of amiable protest ensued, and she remained seated.
"I am fearful of what is happening in London," she said. "These strikes, this unrest, surely it is not the answer. What will they achieve? Only sting our leaders to harsh reprisals. The tower will echo with the laments of honest men."
The young man thumped the table with a thick pink fist.
"What is the alternative, madam? Sit quiet. The magicians won't thank us if we do. They'll grind us further into the dirt. We must act now. Remember, they can't imprison everyone."
There was a round of ragged clapping. The old lady stubbornly shook her head.
"You're quite wrong," she said. "Your argument only works if the magicians can be destroyed. They cannot."
Another man spoke out.
"Steady on, Grandma. That's defeatist talk."
She jutted her chin.
"Well, can they? How?"
"They're obviously losing control, or they'd have beaten the rebels easily." "We can get help from the Europeans, too," the young blonde man added. "Don't forget that. The Czechs will fund us, and the French."
George Fox nodded.
"French spies have given me a couple of magical items," he said, "just in case of trouble. Never had to use them, mind."
"Excuse me," the old lady said, "but you've not explained how a few strikes will actually bring the magicians down."
She raised her bony chin and looked defiantly around at the company.
"Well?"
Several of the men made noises of disapproval, but were too busy sipping drinks to voice an exact reply. From behind the bar, Kitty spoke.
"You are right, madam, that defeating them will be difficult," she said in a quiet voice. "But it is not impossible. Revolutions have succeeded dozens of times. What happened to Egypt, Rome, or Prague? All were invincible for a time. All fell when the people stirred themselves."
"But, my dear," the old lady said, "in each case there were enemy armies."
"In each case," Kitty went on determinedly, "foreign leaders took advantage of the kingdom's internal weaknesses. The people were already rebelling. They didn't have strong magic or vast armies. They were commoners, just like us."
The old lady pursed her lips into a humourless smile.
"Perhaps. But how many of us want an invasion by foreigners? Our rulers may not be perfect, but at least they're British."
The young bearded man snorted.
"Let's get back to now. Tonight the Battersea steelworkers are going on strike just down the river from here. Come and join us. So what if the magicians send their demons? They will get no more cannon from us."
"And where will your steelworkers be?" the old lady said harshly. "Some in the tower, some at the bottom of the Thames. And others will take their place."
"The demons won't get it all their own way," the young man said. "Some people have resilience. You must have heard of it. They can withstand attacks, see through illusions."
As he spoke, Kitty's eyes suddenly cleared. She saw beyond his thick moustache, his scruffy blonde beard. She knew him, clear as day. Nick Drew, last surviving companion in the Resistance. Nick Drew, who had fled Westminster Abbey in their darkest hour, leaving his friends behind. He was older, stouter, but full of the same old bluster. "You still talk a good fight," she thought viciously. "You always were good at talking. I bet you'll keep well away when the strike gets nasty." A sudden fear took hold of her. She stepped back out of his line of sight. Useless though Nick was, if he recognized her, her cover would be blown. The group was busy discussing the phenomenon of resilience.
"I could see magic, clear as day," a middle-aged woman said. "That's what I've heard."
The old lady shook her head again.
"Rumours, cruel rumours," she said sadly. "This is all second-hand tittle-tattle. It would not surprise me if it wasn't started by the magicians themselves to tempt you into rashness. Tell me," she went on, "has anyone here ever actually seen any of this resilience in action?"
A silence in the frog. Kitty shifted impatiently from one foot to another, longing to speak. But Clara Bell was no one special. She'd decided that long ago. Besides, wariness of Nick prevented her. She looked around the taproom. The company, most of which had met there in secret for many years, was generally middle-aged or older. Resilience was not something they knew much of, first-hand. Except Nick Drew, who possessed at least as much resilience as Kitty. But he sat quiet, saying nothing. The mood in the room had been soured by the argument. After a few minutes' glum reflection, the old gentleman got slowly to his feet again.
"Friends," he began, "let us not be downcast. Perhaps the magicians are too dangerous to fight, but we can at least resist their propaganda. A new issue of Real War Stories is out today. Spurn it. Tell your friends about its lies."
At this, George Fox spoke up.
"I think you're being a bit harsh there."
He raised his voice against the general murmur of disbelief.
"Yes, I've made it my business to collect as many editions of Real War Stories as I can."
"Oh, shame on you, Mr. Fox,"
said the elderly lady in a quivery voice.
"No, I'm proud to admit it," he went on. "And if any of you choose to pay a visit to the restrooms later on, you shall find ample proof of those pamphlets' worth. They are most absorbent."
There was a general laugh. Keeping her back to the young blonde man, Kitty stepped forward with a pitcher to refill a few glasses.
"Well, time is moving on," the old gentleman said, "and we must part. But first, as is traditional, we will take our usual oath."
He sat down. George Fox reached under the bar and drew out a large cup, aged and battered, with a pair of crossed dominoes rampant on the lid. It was made of solid silver. He took a dark bottle from a shelf, and removing the lid, poured a generous measure of port into the cup. Kitty took the cup in both hands and carried it to the old gentleman.
"We shall all drink in turn," he said. "May we live to see the day when a commoner's parliament is established once again. May it uphold the ancient rights of every man and woman to discuss, debate, and dissent from the policies of our leaders, and hold them accountable for their actions."
With due reverence, he lifted the cup and took a sip, before passing it clockwise to his neighbour. This ritual was a high point of such meetings at the Frog. After the debates, which never reached any conclusion, it offered the solace of something fixed and familiar. The silver cup was slowly passed from person to person, from table to table. Everyone awaited its arrival, old hands and newcomers alike, except for the elderly lady, who was readying herself for departure. George moved round to the front of the bar, and together with Sam, the bartender, began clearing glasses from tables near the door. Kitty accompanied the cup, moving it between tables when required. She kept her face turned from Nick Drew as best she could.
"Do we need more port, Clara?" George called. "Mary there had a great big gulp. I saw her."
Kitty took the cup, inspected it.
"No, we've plenty left."
"Good enough. My dear lady, surely you're not leaving us?"
The old woman smiled.
I must go, dear. With all these disturbances on the street, I'll not stay out too late.
Yes, of course. Clara, bring this lady the cup so she can drink before she goes.
Right you are, George.
Oh, it's not necessary, dear. I'll take a double drink next time.
This roused laughter and a few cheers. One or two men got up to allow the old woman to squeeze by. Kitty followed her.
Here you are, madam. There's plenty left.
No, no, I really must be going, thank you. It's so late.
Madam, you've dropped your shawl.
No, no, I can't wait. Excuse me, please.
Steady on, love. Watch where you're pushing.
Excuse me, excuse me.
Stony-faced, her eyes dark and blank, like the cut-out holes on an empty mask, the old woman moved rapidly across the room, turning her head repeatedly to look back at Kitty, who was advancing fast behind her. Kitty held the silver cup outstretched, first reverently, as if offering up a gift, then suddenly jerking it back and forth like a fainting blade. The proximity of the silver seemed to give the lady discomfort. She flinched away. George placed his stack of glasses carefully on a side table and put a hand into a pocket. Sam opened a cupboard on the wall, reached in. The rest of the company remained seated, expressions caught between amusement and uncertainty.
"The door, Sam," George Fox said.
The old woman darted forward. Sam turned to face her, blocking the door. He held a short, dark rod in his hand.
"Hold on, lady," he said reasonably. "Rules are rules. You've got to take a drink from the cup before you go. It's a sort of test."
He made an embarrassed gesture and looked ruefully at her.
"I'm sorry."
The old lady stopped, shrugged.
"Don't be."
She raised a hand. A blue light stabbed from her palm, engulfing Sam in a crackling network of bright blue force. He leapt, shuddered, danced oddly like a puppet, then fell smoking to the floor. Someone in the taproom screamed. A whistle sounded, shrill and impertinent. The old woman turned, her cupped hand raised and steaming.
"Now then, my dear."
Kitty threw the silver cup into the old woman's face. A flash of bright green light, a hiss of scalding. The old lady snarled like a dog, clutched at her face with clawing fingers. Kitty turned her head.
"George!"
From his pocket the landlord drew a small box, delicate and oblong. He threw it to Kitty, hard and fast, over the shouting, rising heads of the nearest men and women. She caught it in one hand, spun in a single movement to toss it at the writhing figure. The old lady removed her fingers from her face, which had largely disappeared. Between the neat white hair and the necklace of pearls at her throat, a misshapen mass was glistening. It had no regular shape, no features. Kitty was taken aback. She hesitated. The faceless woman lifted her hand, and another bright stream of sapphire light shot out, striking Kitty head-on, engulfing her in a vortex of shimmering energy. She groaned. Her teeth rattled in her skull. Every bone seemed to be shaking free of its neighbors. Dazzling lights blinded her. She sensed her clothes singeing on her body. The attack ceased. The lines of blue energy vanished. From where she had been suspended, about a meter up, Kitty fell limply to the ground. The old lady flexed her fingers, grunted in satisfaction, and looked around the taproom. In all directions people were fleeing, knocking over tables, sending chairs flying, colliding with each other, squealing in mortal fear. The young, blond-haired man had hidden behind a barrel. Across the room she spied George Fox edging toward a chest beside the bar. Another blast, but he had launched himself desperately to the side. A section of the counter disintegrated in a heap of glass and matchwood. George Fox rolled away behind a table out of view. Ignoring the laments and scurryings around her, the old lady turned to leave once more. She adjusted her twin set, brushed a stray coil of grey hair from her ruined face, stepped across Sam's body and reached for the door. Another whistle, shrill and impertinent, sounded above the clamour. The old lady froze with her fingers on the handle. She cocked her head and turned. Then Kitty, whose eyes were slightly crossed, whose clothes were streaked and torn, whose hair frizzed all about her like a mane of cotton wool, but who had struggled to her feet again regardless, tossed over the small box. As it landed at the old lady's feet, Kitty spoke a single word. A burst of light, searing in its intensity. A column of flame, 2 meters in diameter, rose from floor to ceiling. It was utterly smooth-sided, more like a pillar than a moving thing. It surrounded the old lady on all sides. She could be seen transfixed within it, like an insect within amber. Grey hair, pearl necklace, blue dress, all. The pillar became solid, suddenly opaque, and the old woman was hidden within it. The light faded. The pillar became faint and nebulous. It vanished, leaving a perfectly circular burn mark on the floor. The old lady with the molten face was gone. At first, the taproom of the Frog was very still. A wasteland of upturned tables, smashed chairs, wood fragments, prone bodies, and scattered dominoes. Only Kitty stood, arms poised, breathing hard, staring at the space before the door. Then, one by one, the members began to express their shock and fear. They moved upon the floor. They stirred. They slowly rose. They began to moan and babble. Kitty remained silent. She looked toward the ruined bar. From a distant point along it, George's face emerged. He stared at Kitty wordlessly. She raised an eyebrow.
Well? Let them get their breath back. Then they can go. The sphere mustn't notice anything.
With slow, stiff movements, Kitty clambered over the nearest pile of shattered wood and stepped around the body of the bartender. Pushing aside a teary gentleman who was blundering toward the exit, she locked the door. She stood there for 5 minutes while the frightened customers recovered. Then she let them out, one by one. Last to leave was Nicholas Drew, who had emerged from behind his barrel. Their eyes met. He paused at the door.
"Hello, Kitty," he said. "Still as energetic as ever, I see."
Kitty's expression did not change.
"Nick."
The young man smoothed back his hair and began buttoning his coat.
"Don't worry," he said. "I'll forget I've seen you. New life and all that."
He looked around the debris of the room.
"Unless you want to join up with the Commoners' Alliance, of course. We could do with someone like you."
She shook her head.
"No, thanks. I'm happy as I am."
He nodded.
"Right.
Well, then.
Goodbye. And, good luck."
"Goodbye, Nick."
She closed the door behind him. George Fox was hunched over Sam's body. White, terrified faces peeped in from the kitchen. Kitty leaned back against the door and closed her eyes. Just one demon, one spy, had done this. In London there were hundreds of them. At the same time, next week, the people would return to the Frog to talk, debate, and do nothing. Meanwhile, every day across London, voices of protest were briefly heard and swiftly, ruthlessly, cut off. Demonstrations were useless. Talk was useless. There had to be another way. Perhaps there was. It was time to carry out her plan. Chapter 12. Nathaniel. Night had fallen upon the Prime Minister's mansion at Richmond. Upon the western lawns a number of tall columns had been built. From their tops burned coloured imp-fires, illuminating the scene with weird radiance. Servants in the vibrant garb of firebirds and salamanders drifted here and there, offering refreshment. From the black wall of trees beyond the lake, invisible musicians played a sweet pavan. The sounds carried gently above the voices of the guests. The great ones of the empire meandered about the garden, talking quietly, listlessly, looking at their watches. They wore formal gowns and dress suits. Their features were concealed behind ornate masks depicting animals, birds, and demons. Such parties were among Mr. Devereux's many extravagances, and had become quite common during the period of the war. John Mandrake leaned against a pillar, watching the guests drift by. His mask was made of flakes of moonstone, sewn cleverly together, to resemble an albino lizard's head. Doubtless it was skillful, an object of wonder, but it still didn't fit. He found it difficult to see, and had twice stepped into the flower beds. He sighed. No word yet from Bartimaeus. He would have expected something by now. A small group passed him, a peacock surrounded by two attentive she-lynxes and a fawning dryad. In the peacock's paunch and self-important strut, he recognized Mr. Collins. The women were probably lower magicians from his department, eager for advancement. Mandrake scowled. Collins and the rest had not been slow to criticize him when he'd brought up the staff in council. He'd spent the rest of the meeting enduring a dozen sly insinuations, as well as Devereux's frosty glances. No question about it, his proposal had been ill-advised, a foolish blunder for a politician. To hell with politics. Its conventions smothered him. He felt like a fly caught up in a choking web. His whole life was spent appeasing Devereux, fighting off his rivals. An utter waste of time. Someone was needed to steady the Empire before it was too late. Someone had to defy the others and use the staff. Before he'd left Whitehall, Mandrake had descended to the vaults below the Hall of Statues. He had not been there for years. Now, as he stood at the foot of the stairs, he was surprised to see a line of red tiles embedded in the floor at the far end of the chamber. A portly clerk, who had leapt up from a desk, approached. Mandrake nodded to him. "I wish to inspect the treasure vaults, if possible."
"Certainly, Mr. Mandrake. Would you follow me?"
They crossed the chamber. Beside the red tiles, the clerk halted.
"At this juncture, sir, I must ask you to remove any magical objects about your person and to dismiss any invisible presence. The line marks a boundary. Beyond the tiles, nothing magical is permitted, not even a charm. The merest trace will invoke a terrible sanction."
Mandrake scanned the dim, bare corridor ahead.
"Really? Of what kind?" "I am not permitted to say, sir. You have nothing eerie to declare? Then we can proceed."
They entered a maze of blank stone passages, more ancient than the Parliament buildings above. Here and there were wooden doors, dark openings. Electric bulbs lit the central corridor. Mandrake looked hard, but saw no clue to the hidden trap. The clerk looked only straight ahead. As he walked, he hummed quietly to himself. At length, they arrived at a great steel door. The clerk pointed.
"The Room of Treasures." "May we go in?" "That would not be advisable, sir. There is a viewing grill, if you desire."
Mandrake stepped forward, flipped back a tiny hatch in the center of the door. He squinted through. Beyond was a brightly lit room of considerable size. Far off in its center stood a plinth of pink-white marble. On the plinth, in open view, were the most precious treasures of the government. A little pile of ornaments, glinting with a dozen colors. Mandrake's eyes instantly picked out the long wooden staff, rough and unadorned, with a plainly carved knobble at its head. Beside it, he glimpsed a short gold necklace with a small gold oval suspended from it. In the center of that oval came the deep, dark flash of jade. Gladstone's staff and the amulet of Samarkand. Mandrake felt the sharp internal pain of dispossession. He scanned the first three planes. There was no evidence of hexes, wires, webs, or other guards. Even so, the tiles around the plinth were an odd green color. They had an unhealthy look. He stepped from the grill.
"What guards the room, if I am permitted to be told?" "A pestilent, sir. A particularly voracious one. Would strip you to the bone in seconds, sir, should you decide to enter unadvisedly."
Mandrake looked at the clerk.
"Quite. Very well. Let's go."
A gust of laughter drifted from the house. Mandrake stared down at the blue cocktail in his glass. If his visit to the vaults had proved one thing, it was that Devereux fully intended to cling to power. The staff was out of reach. Not that he actually intended to. Well, he didn't know what he intended. A sour mood was on him. The party and all its fripperies left him cold. He lifted the glass and gulped the liquid down. He tried to remember when he had last been happy.
"John, you old lizard, I see you skulking on that wall."
Across the lawns came a short, round gentleman, splendidly attired in turquoise evening dress. His mask depicted a ferociously laughing imp. On his arm was a tall, slender youth wearing a mask like a dying swan. The youth giggled uncontrollably.
"John, John," the imp said, are you not having the devil of a time?"
He slapped Mandrake playfully on the shoulder. The youth guffawed.
"Hello, Quentin," Mandrake murmured. "Having fun?"
"Almost as much as dear Rupert."
The imp pointed toward the house, where a capering figure with a bull's head was illuminated against the windows.
"It does take his mind off things, you know, poor dear."
Mandrake adjusted his lizard mask.
"And who is this young gentleman?"
"This," the imp said, hugging the swan's head to him, "is young Bobby Watts, star of my next extravaganza. A boy of meteoric talent. Do not forget, do not forget,"
the imp seemed a little unsteady on his feet, "that the premiere from Wapping to Westminster is almost upon us.
I am reminding everyone. 2 days, Mandrake, 2 days. It is guaranteed to change the lives of all who see it. Eh, Bobby?"
He pushed the youth away from him roughly.
"Now go and get us another drink. I have something to say to my scaly friend here."
The swan's head departed, stumbling across the grass. Mandrake watched him silently.
"Now, John."
The imp drew close. "I've been sending you messages for days. I believe you've been ignoring me. I want you to come visit me tomorrow. You won't forget, will you? It's important." Beneath his mask, Mandrake wrinkled his nose at the smell of drink wafting from the other man.
"I'm sorry, Quentin. Council dragged on and on. I couldn't get away. Tomorrow it shall be."
"Good, good. You always were the brightest one, Mandrake. Keep it that way. Good evening, Sholto. I believe I recognize you in the..."
A hulking figure with the incongruous mask of a baby lamb was passing. The imp detached itself from Mandrake, playfully jabbed the newcomer in the belly with a finger, and waltzed away. The lizard and the lamb regarded each other.
"That Quentin Makepeace," the lamb said in deep, heartfelt tones. "I do not like him. He is impudent, and I believe mentally unsound."
"He has high spirits, certainly."
Privately, Mandrake shared the sentiments.
"Well, well, I have not seen you for some time, Sholto."
"No, indeed. I have been in Asia."
The big man sighed, leaned heavily upon his stick.
"I am reduced to scouting for my own goods now. Times are hard."
Mandrake nodded. The fortunes of Sholto Pin had never fully recovered after the destruction of his flagship store during the Golem's Reign of Terror. Although he had laboriously rebuilt his shop, his finances became parlous. This coincided with the war and the disruption of trade. Fewer artifacts were finding their way to London, and fewer magicians were willing to buy them. Like many in the last few years, Pin had aged noticeably. His massive frame seemed slightly shrunken. His white suit hung listlessly about his shoulders. Mandrake felt a certain pity for him.
"What news from Asia?" he asked. "How goes the Empire?"
"These foolish costumes. I swear they have given me the most ridiculous one of all."
Pin lifted the lamb's mask and dabbed a handkerchief at his sweating face.
"The Empire, Mandrake, is floundering. There is talk of rebellion in India. Hill magicians from the north are busily summoning demons for the attack, or so word has it. Our garrisons in Delhi have asked our Japanese allies for assistance defending the town. Imagine that. I fear for us. I really do."
The old man sighed, replaced his mask.
"How do I look, Mandrake? Like a sprightly lamb?"
Inside his mask, Mandrake grinned.
"I have seen Nimbler."
"I guessed as much. Well, if I'm to make an idiot of myself, I'll do it on a full belly. You, girl!"
He raised his stick in an ironic salute and departed in the direction of a serving maid. Mandrake watched him go, his momentary good humour evaporating rapidly on the chill night air. He looked up at the blank night sky.
"Sitting in a garden long ago, a pencil in his hand."
He tossed his glass behind the column and set off in the direction of the house. In the hallway of the mansion, A little apart from the nearest knot of revellers, Mandrake saw Jane Farrar. Her mask, a bird of paradise with slender apricot plumes, dangled from her wrist. She was stepping into her travelling coat, held out for her by an impassive servant. At Mandrake's approach, he drifted away.
"Going so soon?"
"Yes, I'm tired.
And if Quentin Makepeace buttonholes me about that wretched play of his once more, I shall strike him."
She pouted prettily. Mandrake came close.
"I'll escort you back, if you like. I'm just about finished here, too."
With a careless motion, he removed his mask. She smiled.
"I have 3 gin and 5 foliates to escort me. Should I require them? What can you offer me that they cannot?"
The melancholy detachment that had been growing in Mandrake all evening now ignited into sudden recklessness. He cared nothing for implications or consequences. Jane Farrar's proximity emboldened him. He lightly touched her hand.
"Let us take my car back to London. I will address your question as we go."
She laughed.
"It is a long journey, Mr. Mandrake."
"Perhaps I have many answers."
Jane Farrar slipped her arm through his. Together they progressed along the hall. Several pairs of eyes watched them as they went. The mansion's vestibule was unoccupied, save for 2 menservants standing ready at the door. A log fire crackled beneath a wall of stag's heads and faded coats of arms, stolen long ago from foreign hearths. A great stained glass window on the opposite wall depicted in flat perspective the buildings of central London, the Abbey, the Palace of Westminster, the main government offices standing beside the Thames. The streets were filled with adoring crowds. At the centre of the palace courtyard sat the radiant figure of the Prime Minister, hands raised in a gesture of benediction. The glass glinted dully in the hall lights. Behind rose the dark slab of night. Below the window sat a low green couch, laden with silken cushions. Mandrake stopped.
"It is warm here. Wait while I find my chauffeur."
Jane Farrar did not disengage her arm, but looked toward the couch.
"Or we could both stay here a while."
"True." He turned to face her, his body tingling. She gave a little shudder.
"Did you feel that, too?"
she asked.
"Yes," he said softly. "But don't talk."
She pushed him away.
"It was our sensor webs, you fool. Something's triggered them."
"Oh."
"Yes."
They stood listening to the wood snapping in the fire, to the noise of muted revelry from the garden beyond the passage. Distantly above it all came a high, shrill whine.
"That's Devereux's Nexus alarm," Mandrake said. "Something's broken into the gardens from outside."
She frowned.
"His demons will intercept it."
"Sounds like they're attacking the intruder." From somewhere beyond the stained glass window, strange cries echoed in inhuman throats, together with great noises, like rolls of thunder rebounding off distant mountains. The 2 magicians stood quite still. Faintly they heard shouting in the garden. The sounds grew in volume. A man with dark glasses and a dinner jacket ran past, muttering an incantation as he did so. Dark orange plasms flared in his cupped hand. With his other hand he flung open the main door and disappeared outside. Mandrake made as if to follow.
"We should go and see." "Wait, John!"
Jane Farrar's eyes were fixed upward on the window.
"It's coming this way."
He looked up, transfixed at the panes of glass, which were suddenly illuminated into brief glories of varied colour by a flash of light beyond. The noises escalated further. Now it was as if a hurricane bore down upon them, a screaming, whistling blast of madness and ferocity. Louder and louder it grew. They shrank back. Explosions sounded, and hideous yells. Another flash, and for an instant they saw outlined the silhouette of a giant, monstrous shape, all tentacles, wings, and scything claws, hurling itself toward the window. Mandrake gasped. Farrar screamed. They fell back, pawing at each other. A flash. The black shape filled the window. It collided with the glass. Plink! A small pane in the middle of the window, the one depicting the Prime Minister, burst into 1,000 pieces. Through it came a tiny object, flashing emerald in the hall light, arcing through the air. It fell on the tiles before them with a soft, sad sound, bounced once limply, and lay still. The two magicians stood dumbly looking at it. A lifeless frog. Outside the window, noises continued to be heard, but more faintly now, receding with each second. One or two flashes briefly lit the window, then the night was dark once more. Mandrake bent down to the crumpled frog. Its legs were bent and splayed, its mouth half open, its eyes tight shut. An odd colourless fluid spread slowly out upon the tiles around it. Heart pounding, he used his lenses. On all three planes, the frog looked exactly the same. Nevertheless,
what is this hideous creature?
Jane Farrar's pale face was contorted with distaste.
I shall summon my jinni to view it on the higher planes, then we can dispose—
Mandrake held up a hand.
Wait.
He bent closer, addressed the frog.
Bartimaeus?
Miss Farrar frowned.
You mean this thing is—
I don't know.
Be silent.
He spoke again, louder this time, nearer the poor bent head.
Bartimaeus, is that you?
It is I.
He paused, moistened his lips.
Your master.
One of the forelegs twitched. Mandrake sat back on his haunches and looked up excitedly at his companion.
He's still alive. Did you see?
Miss Farrar's lips were a hard line. She stood a little apart, as if subtly detaching herself from the scene. One or two wide-eyed footmen appeared at the margins of the hall. With angry motions, she waved them away.
It will not be alive for long. Look at the essence draining off. Did you request it to come here?
Mandrake was not looking at her. He anxiously surveyed the body on the floor.
Yes, yes, I gave him an open-door injunction. He was to return when he had information on Hopkins.
He tried again.
Bartimaeus!
Sudden interest flared in Farrar's voice.
Really? And from the sounds we heard, it seems he was pursued. Interesting. John, we have little time for the interrogation. Somewhere nearby, Devereux will have his pentacle chamber. It will be a close-run thing, but if we use sufficient force before the creature loses all its essence, we can— Silence! He is waking!
The back of the frog's head had become blurred and indistinct. The foreleg had not moved again. Nevertheless, one of the eyelids suddenly flickered. By minute increments it opened. A bulging eye looked forth, misty and unfocused.
Bartimaeus!
A tiny voice, as if from far away.
Who's asking?
Mandrake!
Oh, thought it was worth waking up for a minute there.
The head sagged, the eyelid drooped. Miss Farrar stepped close and nudged the frog's leg with the toe of a pointed shoe.
Fulfill your mission, she said. Tell us about Hopkins.
The frog's eye opened a little. It swiveled painfully and focused for an instant on Miss Farrar. The tiny voice sounded again.
Is this your bird? Tell me she's not. Oh, dear.
The eye closed, and despite all Mandrake's pleas and Farrar's commands, did not reopen. Mandrake sat back on his heels and ran a hand distractedly through his hair. Farrar laid an impatient hand on his shoulder.
Pull yourself together, John! It's only a demon. Look at the spilled essence. If you don't take steps right now, we'll lose the information.
He stood then and looked at her wearily.
You think we can wake it? Yes, with the right techniques. The shimmering coil or the essence rack, perhaps. But I'd say we've got less than 5 minutes. It can no longer maintain its form. Those techniques would destroy it. Yes, but we'd have the information. Come on, John. You.
She snapped her fingers at a manservant, hovering at the fringes of a small knot of watching guests.
Over here. Bring a dustpan or some kind of shovel. We need to scrape this mess up fast.
No.
There is another way.
Mandrake spoke quietly, too quietly for Miss Farrar to hear. As she issued orders to the men around her, he crouched once more beside the frog and uttered a long and complex incantation under his breath. The frog's limbs shivered. A faint grey mist dribbled off its body, as of cold air meeting warm. With great speed, the body of the frog melted into the mist, The mist coiled about Mandrake's shoes and ebbed away. Miss Farrah turned around in time to see Mandrake rising. The frog was gone. For a few seconds she gazed at him dumbfounded.
"What have you done?"
"Dismissed my servant." His eyes were fixed elsewhere. The fingers of one hand fiddled with his collar.
"But the information about Hopkins!"
She was genuinely bewildered.
"Can be acquired from my servant in a couple of days,
by which time his essence will have healed sufficiently in the other place for him to be able to talk to me."
2 days?
Miss Farrah uttered a little squeal of anger.
"That might be far too late. We have no idea what Hopkins—"
"He was a valuable servant," Mandrake said. He looked at her, and his eyes were dull and distant, though his face had flushed at her words. "It will not be too late. I will talk to him when his essence has healed." Miss Farrah's eyes flashed darkly. She stepped close, and Mandrake caught a sudden wave of pomegranates with a hint of lemon.
"I would have thought," she said, "that you valued my regard rather higher than the spilled slime of a fading demon. That creature failed you. It was charged to bring you information, and it could not do so. Important intelligence was there for us to take, and you released it."
"Only temporarily." Mandrake had waved a hand, spoken a breathless syllable. A bulb of silence surrounded them, blocking their words from the sizable crowd now jostling at the garden entrance of the hall. They all still wore their masks. He glimpsed the sparkling, vibrant colours, the strange, exotic shapes, the blank eye slits. He and Farrah were the only magicians who were maskless. It made him feel exposed and naked. Furthermore, he knew that he had no real answer to her anger, for his actions had taken even himself by surprise. This made him furious in his turn.
"Please control yourself," he said coldly. "I deal with my slaves in the manner of my choosing."
Miss Farrah gave a short, wild laugh.
"Indeed you do! Your slaves! Or perhaps you mean your little friends!"
"Oh, come now."
"Enough!" She turned from him. "People have been hunting for your weakness for some time now, Mr. Mandrake," she said over her shoulder, "and I, inadvertently, have found it. Extraordinary. I never would have guessed that you were such a sentimental fool."
Her coat swirled around her. With imperious steps, she passed through the membrane of the bulb. Without any further backward glance, she stalked from the hall. Mandrake watched her go. He took a deep breath. Then, with a single word, he dismissed the bulb of silence, and was received eagerly by an ocean of noise, kerfuffle, and excited speculation. Part 3. Alexandria, 125 BC. Bartimaeus. That morning, as on every morning, a little group of supplicants gathered outside the apartments of my master Ptolemy. They were there long before dawn, wrapped in their shawls, blue-legged and shivering, waiting patiently for the sun. As light spilled over the river, the magician's servants opened the doors and let them in, one by one. That morning, as on every morning, the list of complaints, wrongs, and outright woes was recited and considered. To some, advice was given. To a few, the more obviously covetous or deluded, help was refused. To the rest, action of one sort or another was promised and delivered. Imps and foliots departed through the windows and flitted out across the city on a variety of errands. A certain noble jinni was seen to leave, and in due course return. For several hours a steady stream of spirits came and went. It was a very busy household. At 11:30 the doors were shut and locked for the day. Thereafter, by a back route, to avoid lingering petitioners who would have delayed him, the magician Ptolemy departed for the library of Alexandria to resume his studies. We were walking across the courtyard outside the library building. It was lunchtime, and Ptolemy wished to get anchovy bread in the markets on the quay. I strolled beside him as an Egyptian scribe, bald-headed, hairy of leg,
busily arguing with him on the philosophy of worlds. He claimed that any connection between the two must be for a purpose. It was the job of magicians and spirits to work toward a closer